Hudson Taylor, In Early Years, The Growth of the Soul, Chapter 2, Unto Children's Children, 1786 to 1824. For myself and for the work I have been permitted to do for God, I owe an unspeakable debt of gratitude to my beloved and honored parents, who have entered into rest, but the influence of whose lives will never pass away. Thus wrote, many years later, the child who came into Gladden James Taylor's home in Barnsley in 1832. This was not, of course, the first James Taylor, who had long since passed to his reward, nor was it even the son who had grown up to take his place. Two generations had come in between the visit of John Wesley to Barnsley and the birth of the child whose experience we are to trace, in whose life the character building of those early days was to bear rich fruit, that at age 50 years of age, amidst all responsibilities of a great mission in China, he should look back with unspeakable gratitude upon the training of his childhood, shows that there must have been right influences at work in that quiet home. What were they? Wherein did these parents lay their son under such indebtedness? What had they received themselves that was to prove of so much value to others? These are important questions, the answers to which reveal the faithfulness of a covenant-keeping God, whose blessing is promised unto children's children. James Taylor, the stonemason, with whom our story opened, had the joy of seeing the beginning of this blessing before he passed away. The little society he had been the means of founding seems to have grown rapidly after Wesley's visit. Dame Betty's kitchen was no longer able to accommodate the services, and step after step they were led into building for themselves a modest chapel on Pinfold Hill near the busiest part of the town. Among the first to be received into fellowship in the newly completed building was young John Taylor, the stonemason's eldest son. This double joy must have been the crowning experience in his father's life, which only a few months later drew to its unexpected close. Nothing is known about his passing away, save that it took place in 1795, and even his resting place cannot now be traced. His was a lowly life, and he waits the resurrection of an unrecorded grave, but in the family he founded and the cause he loved, there remained to this day better memorials of his faithful service than any of the recognition of man can raise. Well, it was for Dame Betty and the younger children that John was able, in some measure, to take his father's place. He was now 17 and in regular employment, having learned the trade of a reed maker, at which he ultimately achieved success. Linen weaving was then, as it still is, one of the principal industries of Barnsley, and many were the hand looms kneading the slender reeds between which the shutters flew. John Taylor worked hard and conscientiously, and by degrees became of great consequence to the staple trade of the town. He was able, from the first, to take his share in the support of the family, and ere long began to look forward to a home of his own on a very simple scale. For hardly had he grown to manhood before he came to know and love Mary, the daughter of William Shepherd of Bradford, who happily returned his affection. The parents seem to have been of Scotch extract, and one cannot but be interested in them because of this union, which was to bring into the Taylor family qualities of inestimable value. All researches hitherto have failed in discovering much about William Shepherd, save that he was governor of a Gaol, G-A-O-L, probably in Yorkshire, the best-tempered man in the world, and a consistent Christian. Tradition adds that he was one of Wesley's earliest preachers and occupied a position of influence among the Methodists. Be that as it may, he certainly handed on to his daughter unusual strength of mind and body, as well as principles of sincere and simple godliness. It was not in Bradford, apparently, that the Shepherds were living at the time of the engagement. That would have been a far cry for busy people, 20 miles country coach ride from Barnsley. And the register still preserved in the beautiful church of Darfield, the bride is entered as Mary Shepherd of this parish, and Darfield is within easy reach of Old Mill Lane. There it was, at any rate, that the young folks did their courting, when Mary was a tall, stately lassie with a warm heart under a quiet exterior, and John, with all his practical qualities, was a music-loving merry lad of only 21. But young as they were, he was able to provide for the girl he loved. On Pinfold Hill, near the chapel, a little home was waiting, and Mary was fitted to make it all a home should be. And so in All Saints Church, overlooking the valley where the dove runs into the Darney, they were married one May morning in 1799, and thence through blossoming hedge rows wended their ways together to the neighboring town. It still stands, that quaint old cottage with its sunny kitchen and hospitable open door, the last house in a quiet court that ere long was to resound with children's merry laughter. Across the street also may still be seen the outside stairwell leading to John Taylor's workshop. It was a steep climb for little feet, but doubtless they helped to wear the stone so smooth with many a journey to call father when he stayed away too long. For the cottage overflowed with boys and girls and the factory with business till the reed maker must often have been conscious of the blessing of his father's God. In the chapel, too, an overflowing blessing had been given. There John and Mary were both class leaders among the younger people, and his voice and musical ability were greatly valued. Instead of the fathers should be the children. It was a promise so abundantly fulfilled that the premises amply sufficient in James Taylor's days were all too small for the succeeding generation. John Whitworth, the young architect, increased the difficulty when he started an excellent innovation known as the Sunday School. Following the example of Mr. Racy Blasker, he stood about gathering in the untaught children of the streets. Few could be found to encourage, and even he had no idea of the magnitude of the work he was undertaking. But when on the day of opening, no fewer than 600 children crowded in, all eager to be taught. It was evident not only that the school was needed, but that it must have larger premises. And soon even opposers were surprised into approval. The change demeaned the children impressed the town. Two footnotes. The old home of John and Mary Taylor is now known as Sten Court, Five House, and is occupied by an elderly couple, Mr. and Mrs. William Irving, who well remember its former owner. Next footnote. Seven of John Taylor's children lived to grow up. Elizabeth became Mrs. Cope. John took up his father's business and left a large family. Mary became Mrs. Norman. James was the father of Hudson Taylor. William was a stockbroker in Manchester. Sarah died unmarried. And Samuel was, for many years, useful and beloved as a Wesleyan minister. He had a great admiration for his mother and used to say that he owed everything to her, his father dying while he was still a child. End of the footnotes. So much of the landlord of the well-known tavern went in search of Mr. Whitworth and handed him a guinea, with the request that he would never overlook the White Hart Inn when calling for subscriptions. All this happened in the same way. It was soon possible to erect a suitable building near the chapel, which gave the name of School Street to the hitherto quiet lane on which the Taylors lived. Not long after, it became necessary to enlarge the chapel also, which was so much altered and improved that James Taylor would hardly have recognized it had he come back again. The reopening just after Christmas 1810 was a great occasion when curly-headed little James, the grandson who bore his name, was not yet 4 years old. Young as he was, however, the rejoicing of that day, the declarations, singings, and crowded meetings made an impression that never passed away, and long years after he loved to recall the joy with which the chapel his grandfather helped to build was rededicated to the service of God. From the first, the divine hand was upon this little lad and the reed maker's home, preparing him for usefulness. Educationally, he and his brothers had advantages unknown to the older generation, for their parents were able to keep them at school and let them choose their own line of life within reasonable limits. One took up his father's business, another became a stockbroker, and a third a minister. James wished to be a doctor and would have studied medicine had circumstances permitted. This being beyond his reach, he went in for chemistry as the next best thing and was indentured to a friend in a neighboring town. 7 years' apprenticeship away from home made a man of him before he was 21. And the even tenure of a country business gave opportunities for study. He was quick and painstaking, an omniventure reader, and methodical in all his habits. Next to the Bible, theology was his favorite study. Sermons he read extensively, as well as good biographies. In order to make the most of his reading, he developed a system of shorthand on his own account, which he improved and made much use of in the latter years. He had some aptitude for music as well as mathematics, and was devoted to the study of birds, plants, and nature generally. Though not tall in figure, he was strong and active, and with a bright smile and pleasant manner, was decidedly prepossessing. And Lisa thought his mother when occasional holidays brought him home. And from the course of events, it would appear that she was not alone in this opinion. Home was no longer the cottage near the chapel to which Mary Shepherd had come as bride. Prospered in business, John Taylor had built a plain but substantial stone house at the corner of Pitt and York Streets. The situation was good, and the property large enough for the erection of workshops and other premises. Thither the family had married some years previously, in a brighter spot it would have been hard to find when all the young folk gathered home. Though the maze nearby need not have feared comparison. This was another roomy, pleasant house on the opposite side of Pitt Street, occupied about this time by a family with the same number of girls and boys. Naturally, there was a good deal of intercourse between the households. The eldest daughter of Nancy had a voice so sweet that John Taylor called her the Nightingale. The minister himself and Mrs. Hudson were among the reed makers' warmest friends, and many were the Sunday evening when they walked home together from chapel and joined forces at the corner house for an informal service of song. It was in 1824 that the minister's family was transferred to the Barnsley Court. To the parents, it must have seemed like coming home, for their native place, the little town of Holmford, lay only a few miles westward on the edge of the great Grouse Moors. There both Benjamin Hudson and his wife had been born and bred, and from that Yorkshire valley, running back into the Peak Country, and many a mile of mountain, dale, and moor, had come the artistic temperament and courageous spirit of their children, enriched by a heritage of godliness. Mr. Taylor, though not a gifted speaker, was a faithful and devoted minister of the gospel. He was an artist with a decided talent for portrait painting, inherited by three, at least, of his children. But his most prominent characteristic, and one that gave him difficulty at times, was an irrepressible fund of humor. Happily, this also was passed on in measure to his descendants, reproved in the Methodist conference on one occasion for not significantly restraining this tendency. He apologized in a reply so witty that the whole assembly was overcome with laughter. But in Barnsley, he was on his native health. Yorkshire folk could appreciate this dry, droll speeches and pointed exhortations. There and in many other places, he exercised a helpful ministry and was valued not for his own sake merely, but also on account of his family. As for Mrs. Hudson, one looked at her face was enough to inspire confidence and esteem. The accompanying portrait, painted by her daughter Hannah, gives some idea of what she was in later years, though it reveals but little of the strength and sweetness of spirit that made the minister's wife a blessing to many. Three boys and four girls completed the family. Amelia, the eldest, being only 15 when they first came to Barnsley. Young as she was, however, this daughter was a comfort to her parents in no ordinary degree. In addition to careful home training, she had had the benefit of several years in the Friends School at Darlington. Sincerity, thoroughness, and love of industry had become as natural to her as the thoughtfulness for others that made her everywhere beloved, and all she was and did told of a heart wholly given to the Lord. Had it been financially possible, Amelia would have continued her studies at Darlington. But younger sisters needed education with cheerful courage. She took it for granted that she must make way for them and obtain remunerated employment. It was the only way to lighten home burdens. And if her parents never knew how much she felt the sacrifice, Amelia on her part could little realize the mingling feelings of regret and thankfulness with which they saw her set to work before she was 16 to earn her living. The right thing is not always the easiest, but God has his schools for training, and a life left in his hands will never fail of its highest development here and hereafter. So Amelia went to Castle Donnington as governess to three little children in the family of a gentleman farmer. Her pupils were devoted to her and her surroundings congenial. But though happy in her work and gifted for it, she could not but long at times for home, and the holidays that enabled her to visit Barnsley seemed few and far between. Thus it was that, although a special favorite with John Taylor and his family, she was rarely able to join the Sunday evening gatherings at the corner house. Like James and his apprenticeship, she was eagerly feeling the discipline of life. Perhaps this very fact helped to draw them together. He was her senior by about a year, and prepared, though what he had seen of the world, to appreciate her brave, beautiful character. For as was purposed by the heart that planned, those welcome holidays sometimes brought the young governess to the Nancy just when James Taylor was also able to visit Barnsley. Short, indeed, would seem the 10 miles walk when he was homeward bound, and more than usual eagerness winged his feet when he came to know for himself the sweet singer of whom he had heard so much. To his delight, he found Amelia to be lovely in disposition as well as in appearance, and that she thought with all as he did about the deeper things of life. The result was inevitable. A warm affection sprung up between the two, so suited to each other, and before the minister left Barnsley, an engagement had been hallowed by love and prayers of both families that from that day united the names Hudson Taylor. Hudson Taylor. In Early Years, The Growth of His Soul, Chapter 3. Set Apart Unto God, 1824 to 1832. It was long, however, ere the young people were to see much of one another. James had his way to make in the calling he had chosen, and Amelia's holidays came no oftener than before, and though more eagerly desired. But at 16 and 17, a long engagement is inevitable. It brings with it so much of hope and happiness that it is comparatively easy to bear. When the young apprentice returned to Rotherham, it was with stronger incentives than ever to do well. There was new zest in business and study, and the blessing of the Lord so filled his heart that it could not but overflow to others. His employer, perceiving his reliability, decided to put him in charge of the branch establishment in the neighboring towns of Conisborough. Here Hudson Taylor found, as others before him, that prayer and pains with faith in Jesus Christ will do anything. The business prospered, and better still, he prospered in it, according to the suggested promise of the first Psalms. Quote, "And whatsoever ye doeth, ye shall prosper." Psalms 1:3 RV, unquote. With comparatively little leisure in the years that followed, he had a growing love for study, especially for a kind that would throw light upon the Word of God. The Bible was his chief delight, and he longed to share the wealth he found in it with others. At no great distance from Conisborough were many neglected villages to which he made his way Sunday by Sunday, telling in out-of-the-way places the wonderful love of God. He could not but speak, for his own heart was brimming over, and not a few among his hearers were awakened and blessed, seeing which the authorities of the church to which he belonged recognized that the lad was called to this much-needed ministry, and at 19 years of age, his name was added to the list of Barnsley local preachers, of whom his grandfather had been the first. Meanwhile, his fiancée was still at Castle Dunnington, gaining health and experience for days to come. Constant reading kept her mind bright, and regular correspondence cultivated a habit of rapid, easy writing of more value than she could suppose at the time. Her letters were full of interest and did much to encourage the one who received them, as he took up on his own account the responsibilities of life. His apprenticeship over James Taylor had returned to Barnsley, and with money advanced by his father, rented one of the best shops in town. It was a step of faith, for 21 Cheapside was a serious undertaking for so young a man. But the premises were in a good situation, right on the busy marketplace, and large enough to afford a permanent home. One of his sisters took charge as housekeeper for the time, leaving him free to devote his energy to business 6 days a week and do his preaching appointments on Sunday. At least as much work and prayer were given to the shop as to his sermons, with the result that he succeeded in both and became known as a reliable man of affairs as well as a helpful, popular preacher throughout the circuit. At length, after years of uphill work, the way seemed clear before him. He was able to repay his father's loan, and with a home and sufficient income of his own, felt he might claim his bride. It was in the quaint own town of Barton-on-Humber that the Hudsons were living with a long engagement drew to a close. 7 years' friendship had done much to develop the boy and girl into earnest manhood and womanhood, and to prepare them for the union to which they now looked forward. James had learned to pray his way through difficulties, and was full of confidence in God, and Amelia, at 23, more than fulfilled the promise of her girlhood. Her father, whose ministry had taken him to Chesterfield and elsewhere since Barnsley days, was still on in the North Country in charge of the Barton circuit, and had it all been planned on purpose, nothing could have been more delightful under the circumstances than the Nancy and its surroundings. No little comfort, this, amidst the varying fortunes of an itinerary preacher's life, for a something indescribable of old-world loveliness pervaded the little town, seen at its best, no doubt, through lovers' eyes that swept springtide in 1831 from the famous Ferry of the Doomsday book to the fine old churches on the green, dating back to Norman and even Saxon times, the cozy, shrubbery place breathing air of comfort and repose. About it lay an undiluting country noted for its corn, malt, brick, and tiles. The spacious marketplace and numerous windmills bore witness to a measure of commercial activity. But the quaint, irregular streets and picturesque houses half hidden among trees and flowering creepers were more in keeping with the spirit of a bygone time. In the very heart of the town, the preacher's house near the chapel seemed especially a bower of greenery and boom. Multibye Cottage, Multibye Lane, was an address with which James Tower was familiar, but even he can hardly have anticipated the charm of that sheltered home. Within the high old-fashioned wall lay a spacious garden with its lawn and flowers, its fruit trees all in blossom, and a green field beyond where quiet cattle fed. Looking out upon his pleasant scene stood the square red brick house covered with creepers, whose wide windows welcomed the sunshine and almost made the lower room seem part of the outdoors. A sweeter spot could hardly be imagined for a home-like happy wedding, nor a more charming bride than the minister's daughter whom James Taylor had loved so long. Here, then, they were married on April 5th, 1831, in the beautiful church of St. Mary's just beyond the trees. Busy and happy were the days that followed when Amelia found herself again in Barnsley. The John Taylors were still living in a house on Pitt Street, and both there and in the chapel, the welcome she received was warm and chirp, and the more she became known among her husband's friends, the more she was loved with a sweet spirit that seemed to have no thought or conscience of self. Intellect and attractive as she was, there was no desire to shine or make an impression on others. Her voice alone would have brought her notice, but there was a shrinking from display of this or any other gift, yet she enjoyed society, loved to see others admired, and was so good a listener that men and women alike found her companionship delightful. But it was the chemist's home on the marketplace that really saw her shine. There the qualities that made her an ideal wife could not be hidden, and James Taylor most often have realized at his own fireside the truth of that word, quote, "Whosoever findeth the wife findeth a good thing, and obtaineth favor of the Lord," unquote. In all its work and interests, she bore a cheerful part, while caring for domestic matters with a thoroughness and perfection of detail that characterized all she did. Her, quote, class, unquote, of 40 or 50 lads felt the influence of her sympathetic and prayers only less than the girls who became her special care, and one of the joys of her early married life was an old-time revival in the chapel that resulted in the conversion of many of the young people. In his preaching engagement throughout the circuit, she also proved an unexpected help. Preparing his sermons was no longer the solitary task it had been. Together they prayed and studied, and when James Taylor's heart was full and his pen could not keep pace with the thoughts he longed to utter, his wife would take rapid notes and write out for him many a sermon delivered as he paced the little room behind the shop. He was a gifted speaker and gave much care to the preparation of his discourses. In this work, Amelia's pen proved invaluable. Through many a long year and the joy of seeing souls brought into blessing through his ministry more than repaid the sacrifice of time and strength. And then the young wife had the happiness of finding her expectations more than realizing the character her husband sustained as a businessman. He was an excellent chemist and highly respected for his influence in the town. So scrupulous was he in financial matters that he made it a rule to pay every debt the very day it fell due. "If I let it stand over a week," he would say, "I defraud my creditor of interest, if only a fractional sum." In dealing with his customers, he was upright to a farthing or a grain and full of genuine sympathy. He never sued for a bill and did not think it desirable for Christians even to press for the payment of an account. On the contrary, he frequently returned in whole or part sums that his customers would ill afford to spare. More than one neighbor barely able to settle an account was cheerful by his generosity. More than one neighbor barely able to settle an account was cheered by his generosity. "It's all right, John," he would exclaim. "We'll send the bill up to heaven and settle it there." Genteel and kindly to all, he was specially so to the poor and to strangers in sickness or trouble. A foreigner or traveler far from home could always find a friend in the busy chemist. Come again," he would say, if he thought they needed help. "Bring the bottle back when the medicine is done, and I will gladly fill it." Yet he was a keen man of affairs and made his business successful. This was partly on account of skill in the management of money matters and partly through careful attention to detail. His fellow townsmen, recognizing his financial ability, appointed him manager of their building society, an office he continued to fill for 22 years. That he did not regard lightly the duties of such a position may be judged from the fact that he worked out lists of interests at various rates to four or five places of decimals and compiled tables of logarithms to assist his calculations. Public funds were to him a sacred trust, demanding the greatest care and fidelity in their administration. But it was to God above all James Taylor sought to be faithful, and he was possessed by a profound conviction of his infinite faithfulness. He took the Bible very simple and believed it was of all books the most practical if put to the test of experience. In this, too, he met with fullest sympathy from the young wife who was herself so loyal to the Lord. On a day they could never forget, in their first winter together, he sought her Bible in hand to talk over a passage that had impressed him. It was part of the 13th chapter of Exodus with the corresponding verses in Numbers. Sacrifice unto me all the firstborn are mine, mine shall they be, set apart unto the Lord. Long and earnest was the talk that followed in view of the happiness to which they were looking forward to. Their hearts held back nothing from the Lord. With them it was not a question of how little could be given, but how much. Did the Lord claim the best gift of his own giving? Their child was more than their own for being his. To such parents, what could be more welcome than the invitation, nay, command, to set apart their dearest thus to him? And how precious the divine assurance, it is mine, not for time only, but for eternity. Together they knit in silence to fulfill, as literally as possible, an obligation that could not regulate to Hebrew parents of old. It was no ceremony to be gone through merely by a definite transaction, the handing over of their best to God, recalling which the mother wrote long after, quote, this act of consecration they solemnly performed upon their knees, asking for the rich influence of the Holy Spirit that the firstborn might be set apart indeed from that hour, unquote. And just as definitely the Lord responded, giving them faith to realize that he had accepted the gift, that henceforth the life so dear to them was their own no longer, but must be held at the disposal of a higher claim, a deeper love than theirs. Thus springtime came again, touching with tender lovingness their Yorkshire hills and valleys, and on May 21st, 1832, this child of many prayers was born and named after both parents, Hudson, James Hudson Taylor. Hudson Taylor, in early years, The Growth of the Soul, Chapter 4, being read by Peter John Parisi, also known as Brian Dean. Chapter 4, Nurture and Immersion, 1832 to 1839. He was a sensitive, thoughtful little fellow from the first, though bright and winsome as any heart could wish. It almost seemed as though he brought more love than usual into the world, with his great capacity for loving and frailty of health that drew forth all the tenderness of those about him. For he was delicate, unusually so, as his parents soon discovered. This was no little sorrow, and added difficulty to the task of bringing him up to be a brave and faithful follower of the Lord Jesus Christ. As time went on, he was often so far from well that it seemed almost impossible to insist upon obedience and self-control. Yet the very difficulty only made it the more necessary. For nothing in afterlife, his parents realized, could ever compensate for the injury of an undisciplined childhood. But they knew where to turn for strength and grace. Were they not workers together with God in moving this little life for his holy service? If they lacked wisdom for so high a task, as indeed they did, would he not give it liberally according to his promise? So the child grew under a watchful care that could not in present happiness forget its responsibility in coming years. And his parents grew with him. The young mother, lovely as she had always been, developed new depth of character in dealing with the son, and into the father's life came added sympathy and strength. It was around his grandfather's figure, strange to say, that the chapel on Penfold Hill, that his earliest recollections centered. Taken almost from infancy to the house of God, he retained a distinct remembrance of the old-fashioned gallery as it then was, and his father's pew right opposite the pulpit. Immediately behind them was the seat occupied by John and Mary Taylor, whose presence usually inspired a wholesome sense of awe. But Hudson only remembered the smile that lighted his grandfather's face. For when he had been especially good, he was sure to be handed over the back of the pew at the close of the long proceedings to receive his grandfather's commendations and be carried home, to sit on his knee by the fireside and at the well-filled table. This was a regular custom as long as the reed maker lived in a kept open house on Pitt Street. That busy transit from pew to pew and the clasp of his grandfather's arms, bringing a consciousness of duty well done, were the first memories of his childhood, and with them came also of the last time he saw that dear, familiar face. His grandfather was lying very quiet then, and the wondering child was told that he had gone to be with Jesus. There was no fear in the expression, only surprise, when he should be so cold and still. It was his first sight of death and never to be forgotten, although at the time he was only 2.5 years old. There were other childish memories, also of an unusual kind. One was of learning the Hebrew alphabet as he sat on his father's knee, and another his first attempt at authorship a little later. By this time he was 4 and could read and write a little, for he embarked courageously on this literary effort. Was it a fairy tale or a story of adventure, we inquired, when he spoke of this recollection? No, it was a serious recitation of a matter that was burdening on my mind. It was about an old man of 80 who had led a very improper life and had not truly repented. His chances were growing small. I only finished one chapter, laboriously inscribed in large print. It was not very long, from which it will be seen that the child of quick susceptibility entered more perhaps than was good for him into the life of older people until little playfellows grew up to claim their share of attention. This, happily, was the case before long, and by the time he was 5 years old, a younger brother and sister were quite companionable. They were a merry trio and kept each other busy all day long. Teaching Amelia to walk became a great interest to the boys, as Hudson recalled long after, when riding from China for her 19th birthday. Another performance into which they put their whole hearts was the Sunday evening meeting, in which one of the brothers was audience and the other speaker. The father's chair was pulpit too in the little sitting room behind the shop, and it was doubtless his example and the stories told them of James Taylor and the days of Wesley that fired their imagination and made them want to be brave preachers too. For at no time is there greater capacity for devotion or more pure, uncalculating ambition in the service of God than in early childhood, when the heart is full of love to Christ. Little Hudson, for example, was deeply impressed at 4 or 5 years of age by what he heard about the darkness of heathen lands. When I am a man, he would often say, I need to be a missionary and go to China. It was only a childish impulse? Yes, but he meant it with all his heart and meant it because he loved the Lord and wanted to please and follow him. In the same spirit was the prayer of another little one of 5 years old. Lord Jesus, help us to be good brothers to you and to do some of your hard work in Africa and in China. 2 footnotes. 1. Afterwards, Amelia became Mrs. Benjamin Broomhall. 2. Quote, whosoever shall do the will of God, the same as my brother and sister and mother, unquote. John chapter 3, verse 35. End of the footnotes. The first sorrow that overshadowed Hudson Taylor's life was the death of his brother, called after their great-grandfather, William Shepherd. This was a loss indeed, for they had been inseparable companions, and there was no one to fill the empty place. Theodore was still a baby, and he too was taken before long to be with Jesus. Hudson, from this time afterwards, was an only son, but 2 little sisters were spared to grow up, the elder of whom was near enough in age to become his special friend. These early bereavements following the loss of their grandfather could not but make him feel the reality of unseen things and develop his thoughtful tendencies. But though he took life seriously from the first, he was sunny and bright by nature and dearly loved boyish fun. He had eyes and a heart for everything and retained to the end a capacity for enjoyment that was remarkable. Nature was his great delight, and he had the patience, sympathy, and power of observation needed for entering into her secrets. He would take any amount of trouble to cultivate a little fern or flower brought home from the woods, or to learn about the ways of birds, animals, and insects. All living, growing things seemed to possess a charm for him that years only increased. On one occasion in his early childhood, a fair of unusual interest was held in the town. The open space behind St. Mary's Church was covered with stalls and shows of every kind, and the usual attractions of circus, music, and merry-go-round were not lacking. But this fair was specially fascinating to Hudson on account of an exhibition of stuffed birds and animals in which their natural habitats were reproduced as far as possible. Nothing could exceed the expectation with which he set out for the green, the proud possessor of a penny, that over sesame of all delights. And it was a rule of the family that pennies could be had if they were earned, but not otherwise. The parents recognized the importance of teaching their children the value of money, and that honest work is necessary if it is to be obtained. Simple tasks suited to their capacity were devised, such as humming dusters, cleaning windows, or helping in the shop. When they were too young to do anything but play, small coins might be earned by what was called a game of still, which meant just sitting perfectly quiet for a measured time by the clock, 5 or 10 minutes or longer, as the mother might decide. And mother had more in view than the children thought. Having discovered how much good was accomplished by this resting times for the mind and body. Of course, all this was much more troublesome than the ordinary methods of obtaining pocket money, but it had the desired effect, and the pleasure of giving and receiving pennies generally earned was a significant reward for parents and children alike. Thus, the unfortunate habit of teasing for money was entirely obviated. Work for it, and you shall have it, proved a much more satisfactory basis. Well, this particular affair came just when Hudson was rejoicing in the possession of his first whole penny, obtained at what had been to him at no little cost. Of course, it seemed a fortune, the largest, most precious coin he had ever possessed, and what would it not purchase of delight? Joyfully, he climbed the hill to St. Mary's, ran along the lane to Churchfields, and sought among the bewildering variety of attractions for birds and animals of his dreams. It was disconcerting to find a fence around the enclosure, and at the gate an imposing personage of doubtful disputation towards little boys. But producing his penny, he summons up courage to ask admission. To his surprise, he was denied. The man, gruffly imitating that the entrance fee was 3 pence. In a moment, the child's mind gasped the unreasonableness of the situation. No doubt the man would like to have 2 pennies. So would he himself. But that was out of the question. There was only one. I haven't got another penny, he explained timidly. But I will give you this one if you'll let me in. And wouldn't it be better for you to have 1 penny than to have none at all? But the man in uniform was not able to see the point. Nothing daunted, the curly-headed little fellow continued his attempt. Reasonableness and perseverance were among the strongest traits in his character, and surely even a grown-up person would see in time what a mistake it was to refuse 1 penny just because you could not have 2 at once. But alas, the gatekeeper was obdurate. At length, the failure of his arguments and his inaccessibility of the treasure beyond that closed door were too much for the sensitive child. Turning away with tears in his eyes, he ran home sobbing as if his heart would break. Happily, his mother found him and was able to understand. Taking him in her arms, she said quietly, "But the man was doing his duty, my son. He didn't mean to be unkind. Everyone has to pay 2 pennies to see those lovely birds and animals. You have been so good and industrious lately that mother will give you another penny as a reward. Run off again now, and the man will be glad to let you in." This unexpected turn of events brought everything right, and sent such gladness thrilling through the little heart that 70 long years after it had not died away. The mother's gentle discipline had much to do with the happiness of his childhood and gave rise to more than one situation that was long remembered. Such, for instance, was the company dinner, when in attending to her guests she overlooked the needs of her little son. The meal went on, and still the child said nothing, knowing he must not ask for things at table. At length, however, an expedient suggested itself, and a little voice was heard requesting for salt. That, at any rate, was permissible. "And what do you want the salt for?" questioned his neighbor, seeing the empty plate. "Oh," he replied, "I want to be ready. Mama will give me something to eat by and by." On another occasion, he called attention to his needs by inquiring in a pause in the conversation, "Mama, do you think apple pie is good for little boys?" It was not often he attempted to evade home regulations, partly, no doubt, because he knew it would be useless, and partly for fear of giving his mother pain. In all her dealings with the children, she was reasonable and consistent. She made few rules and avoided unnecessary commands, but they knew well that what she said she meant, for she never gave instructions she was not prepared to see carried out. Sometimes Hudson was tempted, like other boys, to see how far he could go and taking his own way. But one distressing experience taught him a lesson that was not soon forgotten. He was intensely fond of reading and was absorbed one winter in a delightful book. He was all eagerness to finish it, but daylight hours were short and full of other occupations, and bedtime could not be postponed. If only he might read at night, but mother always came to tuck him up and take the light away. The story grew in interest, and at length a plan suggested itself. He knew, as everyone did in that orderly house, just where the candle ends were kept for use in kitchen or cellar. It would never be noticed if he took a few of these. Then he could light them one by one, and lying cozily in bed, make progress with his book. At first the thought was startling, and not to be entertained for a moment. But it came again and again until conscious was silenced and he decided to carry it out. A visitor came to spend the evening with his parents just when this stage was reached, and perceiving his opportunity, the child filled his large pockets with a covenant candle ends and went in early than usual to say good night. In the drawing room, the older people were gathered around the fire. The visitor was fond of children, and taking the little fellow on his knee, asked if he would like to hear a story. Dearly as Hudson loved stories, however, especially at bedtime, the warmth of the fire made him anxious to escape. He was painfully conscious that the pocket full of candle ends was on the fireside, and eagerly explained that it was time to go to bed, tried to slip off the too friendly knee. But his mother's voice detained him. It was early yet, and as a special treat, he might stay a little longer to hear the story. But instead of being delighted, the poor child was restless and miserable. The candles must be melting. He knew they were. What if mother should smell the tallow, or it should trickle down into the carpet? At the first pause in the recitation, he urged again, more earnestly than before, that it really was bedtime and he ought not to stay up any longer. The gentleman was disappointed and the parents greatly puzzled, but still the story went on. Finally, after what seemed hours of suspense, he was released and hurried away in his room. His mother quickly followed him to find him weeping bitterly over a pocket full of melted tallows and a story of his own that he was only too glad to pour forth without waiting. Needlessly to say, her sorrow over it all impressed the lesson for which in afterlife he could not be too thankful. One chief advantage of his childhood was that he was too continually under his mother's care. This in itself was a sufficient compensation for the limited means that made it necessary. The father's business prospered and brought in more than enough for present needs. But with the welfare of his family at heart, he felt it desirable to lay by for the future as well as to purchase the premises in which they lived and other properties. This necessitated careful economics in everyday matters. Household expenditures was reduced as far as possible. Luxuries were unknown, and active, practical habits were the order of the day. The children learned to be independent and were well-drilled in thoughtfulness for others. But above all, they grew up in close contact with their parents, as children never can, in a house with many servants, or if they were sent to school. The mother was their companion from morning till night. She it was who worked with them, taught them, did everything for them, and was the sun and center of their little system, radiating light and love without end. This accounted largely for the influence she exerted over her little people. It was second nature to obey her, and she was always there to encourage or restrain. She was a woman of few words and unusual tact, with a quiet way of saying and doing things that was very effective. A mere suggestion from her lips went further than repeated injunctions from some people. "My dear, it is nearly time for dinner, or for tea." This meant clean hands, fresh pinafores, tidy hair, and a race to see who would be first at the table before father appeared. How she managed it, no one could tell, but with entire care and education of the children, cooking to attend to, washing to be done at home, and all the housework, sewing, and mending necessary. The help of only one maid, she invariably kept her surroundings neat and attractive, down to the brightly burning fire and clean swept hearth. The little parlor behind the shop, though consistently in use for meals and lessons, needlework and play, was a picture of comfort and good order. And this not by virtue of the distracting process known as settling to rights, so much as by a happy knack of never letting things go wrong or stray far out of place. It was a cozy spot, this family sitting room, and well in keeping with the simple life to which Hudson Taylor owed so much. Entering from the shop, a long, old-fashioned couch occupied the wall to the right, beyond which a china cupboard filled the corner with shiny rows of crockery and glass. Next came the fireplace at the right angle with the sofa, making that end of the room attractive on winter evenings. The other end was taken up with a window and door, leading to the little yard across which was the warehouse where the father's stores were kept, this window facing west, let in the sunshine when the children were busy in the afternoon with needlework and lessons. A spacious bookcase filled the wall between the fireplace and window, and opposite stood a chest of drawers used as a sideboard between two doors, one leading upstairs and the other down to the kitchen premises. A square table in the middle of the room was protected from draughts by a folding screen in the corner furthest from the fire. At last, but not least, in the estimation of the children, a little window over the sofa afforded interesting glimpses into the shop and marketplace beyond. The chief feature in the room, undoubtedly, was the bookcase, and it had also much to do with the order that prevailed. Over the lower shelves hung a curtain concealing the characteristic device of a mother's household manager. Everything in use for meals or lessons, work or play, had its appointed place in sideboard or cupboard, while magazines, books, and papers found hospitality amongst the ample shelves. But one shelf behind the crimson curtain was unappropriated. Clean and empty, it stood ready for emergencies. Was the room needed for unexpected visitors? The work in hand, whatever it might be, was laid away without embarrassment and just as easily brought out again. Were the older people busy with letters or accounts when the table was wanted for a meal? A place was ready in which ink and papers would be accessible and out of danger. It was a convenient receptacle at tea time for the mother's sewing or the children's toys. But whatever its uses in the daytime, it was always cleared and dusted before night. Simple as such a plan may be, it was effective because of the orderly mind that carried it out and went far towards solving the problem of how to turn one room into so many uses without litter or confusion. Not that a litter was objected to at the right time and in the proper place, but the little hands that made it were expected to put things straight before turning to other work to play. The children came to feel that their amusements must never give other people trouble, and that it is wiser to do at once what has to be done rather than leave it to another time. A place for everything, and in everything its own in its place, was the working room of the household, and that extra empty shelf behind the curtain was more effective than many exhortations. One thing only made a deeper impression in this connection, and that was the fact that mother's belongings never needed tidying. Other people's possessions might be more or less topsy-turvy on occasion, as bright eyes had not failed to discover, but mother's drawers and cupboards stood the test. They never needed settling to rights, because, strange as it might seem, they were never out of order. Personal neatness she taught them in the same practical way, until it became second nature to feel that one must be clean and tidy, however simply dressed. A fresh apron was ready for father's use in the shop every morning, and the mother's print gown and closely fitted cap were just as pretty for breakfast 6 days in the week as her black satin and white crepe shawl reserved for Sunday. She was very pleasing in appearance, and the children were like her. The muslin cap tied under the chin, with its soft tulle edging and white ribbons, well became her calm, sweet face. She had donned it on her wedding day, according to the custom of the times, when a dainty cap was always waiting the bride's return from church. Mother would hardly have seemed mother without the modest headgear. But whether it were the Sunday cap, its gauze ribbons edged with satin, or the more durable muslin from daily years, it was equally fresh and becoming. Sovereignly dressed under any circumstances she could not endure. Pretty washing frocks were prepared for little girls with black alpaca, that's A-L-P-A-C-A, aprons pinned at the edges, and they were trained to feel that it was just as important to be neat and attractive for household work before breakfast as for entertaining friends at tea. A work basin was always ready on their dressing table, and stitches were put in as soon as needed. Even if it meant getting up 10 minutes early on a winter morning, clean tuckers must be sewn in to everyday dresses just as carefully as to best ones. And their brother, too, was made to realize that clean hands and shoes, neatly cut nails, and well-brushed garments were quite as necessary at home as in any company. It was a question of thoroughness and self-respect, and those were essential their parents required in everything. In the same way, the servant, probably an inexperienced little maid, when she came to them, was taught to leave the kitchen in order before she went upstairs to do other duties. The mother herself undertook most of the cooking, and it was while dinner was preparing that the morning's lessons were done. But thanks to careful management, the kitchen was just as pleasant as the parlor. The stone floor was well scoured, and a white border made on all four sides to match his father's hearth. The kitchen range was clean and bright, no matter what might be cooking, and mother's rocking chair made the whole room look cozy. Here at a table reserved for the purpose, the little girls worked at their lessons, while Hudson was similarly employed under his father's supervision upstairs. There was no shirking work or playing truants if their parents were called away. Lessons had to go on just the same, and did with wonderful regularity. Then in the afternoon, their mother had the older children with her while she was busy with her needle. A great deal of sewing had to be done, but she was able to go on with it while they read aloud or wrote from dictation. Many were the hours thus spent in history, literature, and travels. Hard names or unfamiliar words that might not hurry over. No, the dictionary had to be brought, and each difficulty mastered as they came to it. A real lover of books herself, she early inspired them with a taste for reading, and to her accuracy and thoroughness may be traced the unusual power of attention to detail that characterized her son in later years. Industry and perseverance also the children could not but learn from her example. So busy was she that it was the rarest thing to see her take time to enjoy a book, but she often had one propped up before her while her needle flew, that she might catch a sentence now and then without interrupting her work. And the father in his department was just as busy. Through the little window over the sofa, he might be seen hard at work in the shop morning, noon, and night. The children lived in touch with him almost as much as with their mother, and he felt himself no little responsible for their training. Though stern and even quick-tempered at times, the influence James Taylor exerted in the life of his son can hardly be overestimated. He was decidedly a disciplinarian, but without some such element in his early training, who can tell whether Hudson would ever have become the man he was by the grace of God? Do we not suffer in these days from too great a tendency to slackness and easygoing? Even Christian parents seem content if they can keep their children moderately happy and good-tempered. But with James Taylor, this was not the point. Life has to be lived. Work must be accomplished. People must be consecrated, gifted, devoted, and yet of very little use because undisciplined. He was a man with a supreme sense of duty. The thing that ought to be done was the thing he put first, always. Ease, pleasure, self-improvement had to take whatever place they could. He was a man of faith, but faith that went hand in hand with works of most practical kind. It was not enough for him that his children were happy and amused, well cared for and obedient even. They must be doing their duty, getting through their daily task, acquiring habits that alone could make them dependable men and women in days to come. The importance of punctuality, for example, he impressed both by teaching and example. No one was allowed to be late for meals or any other engagement. The mother called the children herself at 7 every morning. No bells were rung, but when the clock struck 8, everyone had to be at the table. If there are 5 people, he would say, and they are kept waiting 1 minute, do you not see that 5 minutes are lost that can never be found again? Dinner was at 12:30 and tea at 4:30. But if these meals were delayed 5 minutes, it would mean nearly an hour wasted out of one little day. And what would that amount up to in a week, a month, a year? Now, that is in dressing or undressing, or in beginning when the time came to begin, he also reprehended as a serious waste of time. Learn to dress quickly, he would say, for you have to do it once, at least, every day of your life. And begin promptly, whatever the work in hand. To loiter does not help. It only makes the task more difficult. See if you can do without was another of his maxims. This, of course, applied, among other things, to the simple pleasures of the table. Porridge with bread and butter for breakfast, meat once a day, and bread and butter or toast for tea was the usual routine. But sugar and preservatives were allowed in moderation, and extra nice cakes or puddings occasionally found on a plate. As a rule, the children shared whatever was provided, their parents delighting to give them pleasure no less than other fathers and mothers the wide world over. At the same time, they fully realized the lifelong influence of little habits. At any cost to themselves and within wise limits to the children, they felt they must secure to them the power of self-control. By and by, the father would explain, you have to say no to yourself when you are not there when we are not there to help you. And very difficult you will find it when you want a thing tremendously. So let us try to practice now, for the sooner you begin, the stronger will be the habit. It was a principal difficulty of application, no doubt, when a favorite dish was in question. But though it was at least as hard for him as for them, he would encourage them to go the whole length on occasion, saying cheerfully, "Who will see if they can do without today?" The children were not blamed if they could not respond as he desired, but were commended if they did, the mother generally arranging some little surprise at night, a few almonds or raisins or an orange, with an extra loving kiss. Sweets or confectionery were never thought of buying for themselves. Pennies honestly earned were far too precious to be squandered thus. Each one had a little brown earthenware jar in the sitting room cupboard in which their savings were kept. Whenever 11 pennies could be produced, their father would add one, giving in exchange a brightening shilling. This was a transaction much looked forward to and encouraged the children in thoughtfulness about the use of money. These may seem trivial details, scarcely worth recording, but it is just such little habits that in the long run strengthened the character and made all the difference between weakness and power to do and to be one's best. The spiritual life of his children was equally the father's care. Family worship he conducted regularly after both breakfast and tea. Every member of the household had to be present, and the passage read was explained in such practical fashion that even the children could not fail to see its application. He was very particular about giving them the whole Word of God, omitting nothing. The Old Testament, as well as the New, was taken in regular course, and at the close of every day's reading, the date was carefully entered in the family Bible. On Sundays, he gave even more time to this home ministry, in spite of the services for which he was responsible, and that often involved a considerable journey on foot. While thoroughly approving of Sunday schools for those who needed them, he did not consider his own children to be among the number, and would relinquish to no one the privilege of teaching them in the things of God. He gave time also to earnest, detailed prayer on their behalf and taught them to pray. From infancy, the little happenings of every day were made occasions for drawing near to God. Nothing was too trivial to interest father and mother because the little folks were dear to them, and nothing is too small to bring to him who loved them better still. If there were something to thank their parents for or obtain help in, they would not wait till the end of the day to do so. And in the same way, they learned to come without ceasing, with thanksgiving and prayer, to the greater Father in heaven. It was just as natural to Amelia, 3 years old, to say reverently, "O Lord, take away my naughty temper and give me a new heart," as to ask pardon of the mother she had grieved, and baby, as she was, she felt it no less important. At one time, the father made it a practice to take the older children to his room every day for prayer. At the big four-post bed, all three would kneel beside him, while with his arm about them, he poured out his heart to God for each in turn in a way they never could forget. It was not much he could give them of wealth or worldly advantage, but he could and did imbue them with a strong, simple faith like his own. He taught them to reverence the Bible as the Word of God from cover to cover, trusting every promise to mean at least all it says. "God cannot lie," he would explain with intense conviction. "He cannot mislead you. He cannot fail." And instinctively, the children began to trust in the same way. As they were able to understand, he explained to them the necessity for maintaining the life of the soul by prayer and Bible study, as the life of the body is maintained by exercise and food. To admit this was to neglect the one thing needful. He spoke of it frequently as a matter of vital importance and arranged for everyone in the house to have at least half an hour daily alone with God. The result was that even the little ones began to discover the secrets of a happy day. Before breakfast in the morning, and again as evening was drawing in, they went up to their own rooms for reading and prayer. They needed it just as much as older people, and in their childish way came to realize that no one can be good and happy all day long without heart-to-heart fellowship with the Lord. But it was example that impressed these things upon them more than precept. Let them see thee talking to thy God was gold counsel these parents did not fail to improve. Thus the children grew in body, mind, and spirit as the days went on. Hudson was still too delicate to go to work school, but the education received at home more than made up for this loss. Not only were his studies systematic and his general intelligence developed, but the conversation of his parents and their visitors awakened thought and purpose to which the average schoolboy is a stranger, and his father's daily life as he grew old enough to share it, in no wise weakened these impressions. James Taylor was sociable and talked freely and in congenial company. He was gifted with warm sympathies and sound common sense, so much so, indeed, that few men in Barnsley were more sought after for advice in temporal as well as spiritual things. Over the counter and in the little room behind the shop, many an hour was spent with those who came to him in trouble. On market days, another class of visitors would drop in, friends from the country, to many of whom he was indebted for Sunday hospitality, and brother local preachers sure of a welcome. A cup of tea by the fireside gave opportunity for many a dish of chat, seasoned with kindly humor, in which the children could not fail to be interested. But quarter day was looked forward to with still more lively expectation, for then fellow workers came in from every part of the circuit, bringing the contribution of those they represented towards the support of the ministry. In the chapel on Pinford Hill, their business was transacted. Arrangements for the following quarter were considered, missionary meetings planned, and financial matters settled, after which luncheon was served in the vestry by the circuit stewards and their wives. Then came an opportunity for private hospitality, which James Taylor frequently improved by inviting one or all to tea at 21 Cheapside. This was a favorite rendezvous, and at 5 o'clock the drawing room over the shop would be well filled with guests. Those were times when conversation was at its best, good, homely Yorkshire talk as racy as it was profitable. And how the children listened. Half a century later, the remembrance had not faded from their minds. I used to love to hear them talk, those local preachers gathered round our table for high tea, theology, sermons, politics, the Lord's work at home and abroad. All were discussed with so much earnestness and intelligence. It made a great impression upon us as children. Footnote to Mrs. B. Broomhall, the, quote, little Amelia, unquote, of those days. We are indebted for many of the recollections incorporated in this chapter. End of the footnote. It was on these occasions chiefly that the subject of foreign missions came up, and the little folk were delighted by many a story from far-off lands. China still held, as it always had, the first place in the father's sympathies, and he used often to lament the indifference of the church to its appalling need. It especially troubled him that the denomination to which he belonged should be doing nothing for its evangelization. Methodists, who in the days of Thomas Coke had been foremost in sending missionaries to the heathen, still gloried in Wesley's motto, "The world is my parish." 100 years had passed since the birth of the Great Revival, and in the summer of 1839, when Hudson was 7 years old, the centenarian jubilee was celebrated on both sides of the Atlantic in a spirit worthy of the memories it recalled. Methodism everywhere exceeded themselves in liberality and zeal for the cause of God. Thank offerings filled their treasuries. Worldwide prayer resulted in a great increase of spiritual blessing, and notable advance was made in evangelistic labors both at home and abroad. But among the new missions projected and the new workers sent out, none were destined for China. It seemed to be taken for granted that nothing could be done or even attempted there. Morrison, the lonely pioneer of Protestant missions in that land, had passed away 5 years previously, and no one had been able to take his place. Canton was still the only mission station recently manned by a few American workers, including Dr. Peter Parker, who had just opened the first hospital on Chinese soil. But beyond the narrow limits of that one settlement lay the whole vast empire with its 400 millions, among whom no one was living and preaching Christ. Footnote, Romanism in China was just recovering from its second period of decline, and foreign priests were to be found at a few points in the interior on the ground of ancient rites. The order of Jesuits, suppressed by Pope Clemens XIV in 1773, had been reestablished half a century later. And from that time, 1822, the Roman Catholic Church entered upon a stronger, more aggressive policy in China. End of the footnote. These things pressed as a burden on the heart of Hudson Taylor's father. "Why do we not send our missionaries there?" he would exclaim. "That is the country to aim at, with its teeming population, its strong, intellect, scholarly people." He could not understand the apathy of the church about this magnificent field, the Gibraltar of heathenism, and the listening children were confirmed in their conviction that this was indeed the greatest, the most neglected, and the most promising of missionary lands. Later on, their interest was increased by Peter Parsley's China, a little book they read and reread until they knew it almost by heart. It had many illustrations, tiny pictures of the old-fashioned kind, and so impressed Amelia that she decided to cast in her lot with Hudson, who had long ago made up his mind to go to China as a missionary. The parents did not fail to notice these childish purposes, though with some sorrow of heart. It had been their chief desire that Hudson might be called to just such service, but on account of his continued delicacy, the hope had been gradually abandoned. He, at any rate, would never be strong enough for such a life. It was manifest, however, that the Holy Spirit was working in his heart, for nothing interested him so deeply as the things of God. He loved to go with his father to the country chapels in which he was preaching Sunday by Sunday. This quickening impulse of the great centenary was being felt in that Yorkshire district, and James Taylor's ministry was in power and blossom. Even his little son entered into the spirit of the time. Love for Christ, the master's passion of his life, and the unquenchable longing to bring others to know and love him too, evidently had their beginning as early as the Jubilee of 1839. For it was of those days his mother wrote. When about 7 years of age, Hudson frequently accompanied his father into the country when he was going to preach. It was the time of a religious revival, and an after-meeting was usually held at the conclusion of the service to pray for blessing upon the word and for the conversion of sinners. On such occasions, persons deeply convinced of sin and desiring to obtain peace with God were invited to come forward to be prayed with and appointed to the Lamb of God that taketh away the sin of the world. In these meetings, his devout and prayerful earnestness were often remarked, and when, as was frequently the case, burdened souls found comfort by resting on Jesus and his atonement, the believer sang, "Praise God from whom all blessings flow." He would join as heartily as any, while his face glowed with delight. But this joy, the spirit of joy in the Lord and concern for the welfare of others, did not depend upon revival meetings. It was fostered by the influence of his parents and the daily atmosphere of home. Much of the conversation was about spiritual things, and of a kind that made salvation and living for God appear, as indeed they are, the most important matters under the sun. And the children could easily see that this was no mere talk, but that their parents were consistent in putting God first and in seeking to help others to do the same. The mother was, for many years, too delicate to carry on her weekly class or attempt much outside work. Her hands were more than full with household duties, but in her own circle her heart still burned with love for souls that could not rest till all within its reach were won. The children knew how she thought of and prayed for the servants that came under their roof and for the successive assistance in the shop. Did they not share her joy when these young people were brought sooner or later, they always were, to the living faith in Christ? Mother's closed door in the middle of the busy day had a word of meaning for the household. Those were the seasons of quietly waiting upon God that renewed her strength and enabled her to make so attractive to others her unseen friend. Happy the son whose every remembrance of his mother affords fresh inspiration to a life of Christ-like love and service. Happy too the children so trained in habits of obedience to their earthly parents that they learn almost instinctively to obey and honor God. To James Taylor, this was a matter of supreme importance. He felt with a deep sense of responsibility that Christian parents are placed at the head of the family as the direct representatives of him, from whom every fatherhood in heaven and on earth is named. To permit disobedience would be not only unfaithfulness to God, but cruel injustice to the children, wholly misleading them as to the character of the Heavenly Father, with whom, through life, they have to do. His duty, on the contrary, was to train them to such prompt and loyal obedience to their earthly parents that they would be prepared to render like submissions to the will of God. He showed them that such obedience requires the exercise of the highest powers, faith, love, patience, self-control, and is a faculty not easily acquired. Unless they learned the lesson in childhood, they would grow up with unyielded wills, too wayward and undisciplined to be of use in the service of God. The sorrow and danger of such a position he showed them from many passages of Scripture, dwelling especially on Eli's failure in governing his sons, the sin and misery it entailed, and the dishonor brought upon the name of God. So much did he dread the consequences of overindulgence that he went perhaps too far in the opposite extreme. But even when he seemed most severe and the children were tempted to rebel, his mother's voice quickly recalled them. "My dear, he is your father, not a word. Remember, honor thy father." But there were aching hearts at times over what seemed a reproof or punishment of needless asperity, as when Amelia was sent to bed one Sunday afternoon for leaving a morsel on her plate at dinner unfinished. But though it caused tears at the time, she came to feel that Father had erred on the safe side, if he had erred at all, and that he and Mother sacrificed themselves in this, as in everything else, for the good of those entrusted to their care. For the children's pleasure, too, their parents thought and planned, and many were the red-letter days that dotted the calendar throughout those early years. Saturday afternoon was always much to look forward to, for then visits might be paid to their friends across the green, to the Nepis or the Cope cousins, whose beautiful garden afforded endless attractions, or better still, Hudson and Amelia would take their hoops in spring and summer and run off alone to the Loon Woods down the Cudworth Road. Perfectly happy in each other's company, they would wander for hours up and down the shady glades, chasing butterflies and gathering flowers to their heart's content. They never thought of quarreling. Hudson was his sister's protector, rather, and considered himself responsible to take care of and keep her happy, though he could not always overcome a boy's tendency to tease. "Now, my child, don't be teased, and he will soon leave off," the mother would say with a smile, well knowing that Hudson's teasing was never more than fun. As a matter of fact, there was nothing he would not have denied himself for the good of his dearly loved sister. While she was still a little afraid to be left in the dark, he would frequently sacrifice an hour with his book by the fireside to keep her company. When it was cold, he would sit beside her on the pillow with his feet underneath the bedclothes, telling the most fearsome, fascinating stories, until she drifted happily into the land of dreams. Their enjoyment of the country was greatly increased by the companionship of their father, who often went with him on Saturday afternoon for long, delightful walks. They loved the butterflies, birds, and flowers about which he told them. It was better to wander with him in such company than even to visit the wonderful fairs on the green. Twice every year, these great occasions came, with all the excitements of shows, menageries, and merry-go-rounds, to say nothing of stalls, passing descriptions. But, though they enjoyed the bewildering scenes, keeping close to the father's side as he led them through the crowds, it was a different and doubtful joy not to be compared with the other. The green woods never palled or left one jaded and dissatisfied. And then at home, one could pursue the subject still. Carefully and orderly as she was, the mother fully entered into the feelings of her little naturalist, and afforded every faculty for the wonderful collection that grew from these country walks. Their father encouraged them too, and subscribed for a magazine of natural history that coming month by month did not a little to deepen intellect interest. One thing the parents specially inculcated was thoughtful consideration for living creatures. To willfully hurt a fly would have been an offense severely punished, and from babyhood their children were made to realize that all cruelty to dumb, helpless creatures was a sin against God himself. "Why, what you sow in this way," the father would assure them, "you will certainly reap. You will be made to suffer for all the suffering you inflict, as God is God and knows everything. Even flowers that might not gather unless they really wanted to keep them, and over their collections of insects and butterflies, the greatest care was exercised." Hudson, who was intently interested in these beautiful creatures, fully shared the solicitude of his parents that they should not be made to suffer. Pillboxes large and small were supplied him from the shop, in which air holes were carefully pricked, so that he might bring home his treasures comfortably. And a little chloroform precluded the possibility of pain. Other happy memories for children and parents alike centered around the festivities that once a year gathered the family circle at Grandmama's. On Christmas Day, her sons and daughters dined with her in state, and on New Year's Day, she resigned possessions to the younger generation. Tall and stately as she was, Mary Shepherd of long ago days inspired only gratitude and affection from her numerous grandchildren. Troops of merry boys and girls played hide-and-seek all over her house and reveled in the good things her hospitality provided. They were quite a clan by this time, though the invitation extended to first cousins only, and certainly none among them had more capacity for enjoyment than the unspoiled little people from the chemist's home on the marketplace. But to them, the happiest days of all were not those high days and holidays. Through the midst of childhood, the brightest associations lingered about one dear figure in the repose that always seemed to accompany a white crepe shawl and satin gown. Sunday was the day on which Mother gave herself to them, as she could not through the week, and if there was one thing she cared about, it was that day should be to every member of the household the happiest and most helpful of the seven. In the morning, the children went with her regularly to the house of God, and there was more leisure to enjoy companionship at home on Sunday. But in addition, Mother had ways and means of making that day different from all others and much to be desired. The nicest toys and picture books belonged to Sunday, as well as the prettiest frocks and a cozy fire in the drawing room because the piano was there. Mother's sweet voice made hymn singing a delight. No talks were like her talks over the Bible, not to speak of Pilgrim's Progress and other books that only appeared that day. Then she always had a basket of fruit for her little people in the afternoon, and just to see her looking so sweet and restful as she shared their enjoyments was not the least part of the happiness of the day. Yes, home was home indeed, and the nearest place to heaven, because it held that mother in whose heart was shed abroad the very love of God.